I'd like to turn things over to our presenters today, Peter Caboli and Matthew Augustine. Guys, can I turn things over to you?
Yes, thanks, Rob. This is Peter Caboli at the Iowa City VA, and actually with me here is...
This is Matthew Augustine. I'm from the James J. Peters VA in the Bronx. I'm visiting Iowa City.
So we're both in the same room and looking at the same computer, and glad you all could join. One of the things that Rob said is that we will take some questions during the presentation. So if something comes up as we're talking that you have a question on, you can go ahead and type it into the chat box, and then we'll be pausing four times throughout to take a couple questions. So the title that we have for today is the Veterans Access to Care Evaluation, Access to Care Update on Metrics and Performance in VHA. And thanks to the Primary Care Analytics team and for inviting us to do this.
Okay. Peter, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I need you to click on that the pop-up so that we can see your slides.
Oh, sorry.
There you go.
Now can you see it?
Yes, we sure can. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Even after doing the run-through, I still did it wrong. Okay, so here's the title of our presentation, and our names on the first slide. So now everybody can see that. Okay, so what our objectives are is we're going to describe findings from VA Office of Rural Health-sponsored Access to Care Evaluation. This is some work that we've been doing over the past few years, and give you some examples of how we've used metrics to evaluate performance in VA. And so we're going to review some of these recent evaluations and describe how VA is enhancing access to care and the metrics that we use in these evaluations. So a couple quick background slides. There was a 2015 Institute of Medicine report that was produced in conjunction with the VA about transforming healthcare scheduling and access. And one of the key findings in this was the original IOM report, Crossing the Quality Chasm, identified six fundamental aims for healthcare: that it be safe, effective, patient-centered, efficient, equitable, and timely. Of these fundamental aims, timeliness is in some ways the least well studied and understood. And part of what we're getting at with access is timeliness. It's not all about timeliness, but it's one of the components. So John Fortney and colleagues had a paper that came out in 2011 that produced what we call a new definition of access for the 21st century, that it represents the potential ease of having virtual or face-to-face interactions with a broad array of healthcare providers, including clinicians, caregivers, peers, and computer applications. And this is broken down into actual, which are directly observable and objectively measurable dimensions of access, and perceived access measures, which are self-reported and subjective dimensions of access. And across this, there are five dimensions of access: geographical, temporal, digital, financial, cultural. And, the various access measures, cover these different dimensions. So as part of the, from fiscal year 18 work that we did, beginning of fiscal year 18, through the Veterans Access to Care Evaluation, came up with 20 different access metrics and produced brief reports on each of them. And they're all available online that describe how these are used in VA and some of the data elements included and some validity testing in some of them. And so we're going to apply some of these today. We're going to be presenting work today that's a collaboration across multiple sites. They include Matt's work. He's at the GREC in the Bronx, people here in Iowa City and Cadre, people at Greater Los Angeles, Palo Alto, and the coordination was all done through the Primary Care Analytics team in Seattle. So these are the five topics that we're going to cover today, and Matt and I are going to go back and forth and cover these one at a time, and then you can ask a couple questions to clarify what we just described. So we're going to talk about extended hours clinics, the use of licensed independent practitioners in call centers, secure messaging in the VA, primary care panel fullness and a novel metric for access to care for mental health services in the hospital. So Matt, you'll take it from here.
Thanks, Peter. So this part of the presentation is looking at specifically at extended hours. And in this analysis, or, you know, the initiation of this analysis that we're doing is we're looking at the association of primary care extended hours with access care metrics that we've used and produced metrics on last year, and also emergency department use, which has been historically a measure of adequate access to primary care. So as many of you know, if you work within the VA, especially within primary care, in 2013, the directive 2013-001 was released in January of 2013 and was expected to be implemented in July of that same year. And it defined what extended hours exactly is. And it's any clinic visits that are beyond normal operation hours, which are defined as 8 a.m. To 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. So any visits, you know, beyond that were considered extended hours. And specifically in that directive, it stated that primary care, including women's health, should offer a full range of services at VA medical centers and CBOCs who are treating more than 10,000 unique veterans at that facility. And they should offer extended hours at least one during the week and one during the weekend. And that is considered two consecutive hours. So they need to offer four in general. And so that was implemented throughout the past years. And as recently, as of October this year, and recently on a seminar for all the administrators, this was updated in the Directive 1231, which stated that, again, that medical centers and community-based outpatient clinics over 10,000 patients need to offer extended hours. However, they relaxed the recommendations to offer it on the weekends or at what specific time. So now they have to, clinics are expected to offer 4 hours of extended hours each week, no matter what the time frame is, as long as it's outside of 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. So last year, we took a look at this in fiscal year 2018 to see, you know, what did extended hours look like overall. And here this is a graph looking at the percentage of total primary care appointments. And as you can see, in 2013, with the implementation of the directive, there's a dramatic rise in the percentage of extended hours appointments offered throughout the VA. This rise was, you know, predominantly seen in what we see that this red line here, which was during the weekend, during that recommendation. And as you can see, as it persisted throughout the last few fiscal years, the time frames in the morning have kind of persistently increased. Weekend hours have decreased, and evening hours have remained pretty low and the same. However, despite this, the directive and the recommendation to offer extended hours, the experiences with FARs access remains the lowest amongst the surveyed questions. So veterans are surveyed through the Survey of Healthcare Experiences of Patients, and they're asked, you know, five different questions: their experiences with routine care, urgent care, regular hours care by phone, after hours care, and after hours care by phone. And after hours care remains the lowest, with right around 20% reporting that, or lower, reporting responding always to getting care after hours. And this has persisted despite the implementation of the policy in 2013. So the question for us was, in this perspective, is can we look at this more objectively? Can we, does extended hours impacting access from the objective measures that we looked at previously? So what we did is we took a national sample from a time frame of July of 2017 to October of 2018. We limited to clinics that had at least one provider and at least 2,000 patients. And our exposure of interest is looking at, you know, the percentage of extended hours and looking at the association with timeliness outcomes, which we defined as same-day access, or this timely care metric, which is getting care within the first 48 hours. We looked at both wait time measures, new patient and established patient. We looked at what I call a capacity measure, which is a third next available appointment, and also ED visits only at VA medical centers. We used some methods of multi-level mixed regression over this time frame. And our findings is that we found an association, a small but significant association, with same-day access. So the greater percentage of extended hours are offered at a clinic, the greater the ability for a clinic to meet same-day access for their patients. We did also see an association with new patient wait time. So although that same-day access increased, we did see a slight lengthening. This is about a half day of new patient wait times. No effect. We saw no association with established wait time or third next available appointment. And also we ran these measures with ED visits, both overall after-hours ED visits and time concordant ED visits. So is morning extended hours associated with morning ED visits? Again, we saw no association. So in summary, we see that clinics that are offering more extended hours, there's slightly increased same-day access among those clinics. There's a modest increase in a new patient wait time. And then there's no association between overall and time concordant ED visits at the VA medical centers. The implications: extended hours may enhance same-day access. While our investigations are are currently ongoing, we're looking to get look at these a little more detail. Clinics in high demand for same-day access may consider continuing or expanding their extended hours to offer a range of time for their patients to be seen the same day. So the next steps that we're taking this analysis is, kind of confirm our statistical modeling. We're going to look at the earlier time frame before July 2017, specifically during the time of implementation, and connect these with, subjective measures of patient experiences and hopefully integrate some non-VA data. We're about to transition, but I can take any questions anybody have right now, if there's any, before we talk about call centers.
At this time, we have no questions. But let me remind the audience that Matthew and Peter would like you to submit your questions during the presentation, and they will address them mid-segment. Thank you.
Okay, so this next project we did was looking at the clinical call centers, and this is specifically the call centers that route calls to licensed independent practitioners, and we wanted to look at the association with emergency department and outpatient visits. And this came out of collaboration with the Office of Nursing Services, who was adopting a model that places like Kaiser Permanente and other health systems have adopted, where by embedding a licensed independent practitioner within the call center, you can achieve sort of first contact resolution. So if you look on the right-hand side, this graphic, you can imagine, a call comes in. If you go in the middle part of that, it can go to a scheduler if there's just a scheduling issue that needs to be taken care of. If it's a nurse question, the nurse can take care of it. There's an algorithm, a triage algorithm that they use. And based upon that algorithm, some of the algorithms, go directly to, hang up the phone and dial 911 or take yourself directly to a hospital. But others allow for judgment by a licensed independent practitioner. And then that LIP can then take the call and either resolve the issue by calling in a prescription or, providing reassurance and then scheduling care later as opposed to coming in right away. So these clinical These call centers are part of this clinic contact modernization and a VA priority to improve customer service, improve our business systems, and respond to the Mission Act. So our questionnaire at the bottom is, does the inclusion of an LIP in the clinical call center reduce subsequent healthcare utilization? So we took advantage of sort of a natural experiment that was going on at the GLA call center. And over this time period from May of 2015 to March of 2019. And the exposure was whether the call got routed to an LIP or otherwise. And what we were looking at is both VA and fee basis use of emergency department visits on that day and the subsequent days, primary care visits, specialty care visits, and hospitalizations that day and subsequently. So the methods we used was that we matched based on the chief complaint and what the recommended follow-up intervals were and the recommended follow-up location. And we used a repeated measures logistic regression analysis technique. And this were based on a 2-to-1 match of propensity match controls. So here are the main findings. So start on the top left there. So emergency department visits were reduced if that call was routed to the LIP. So the LIP is in the red line, and then, you know, it's mainly over that first, in that same day. So you can imagine patients not being sent to the emergency department, but then it dropped off over the days, the next 7 days. The top right there is primary care visits, which I'll show you the numbers, but we're lower for the LIP calls. Same for specialty care and inpatient care. And so on the right there, it says veterans whose calls were handled routinely were more likely to use the ED, the hospital and specialty visits in the days after the call than were veterans those calls were handled by a nurse practitioner. And then even after adjustment, the differences in healthcare use were smaller, but still statistically significant for ED, inpatient, and primary care. Actually, it should have been ED, primary care, and specialty care, not inpatient. Well, I guess it depends on which. We did two different analyses here. The one on the left is probability of any use, and in the adjusted model, ED use was less, primary care use was less, specialty care use was less, inpatient care was less but not significant. And then if you just look at the counts in the adjusted model on the right, it you see it for the ED, primary care, and specialty care. So actually I did have it wrong on the prior slide. So what we found, you know, is that veterans whose calls were routed to an LIP at the GLA call center had fewer subsequent face-to-face clinic visits than veterans who called for similar health conditions and whose calls were handled routinely by registered nurses. And so we felt like that incorporating LIPs into the call center appears to have obviated some healthcare visits. One of the questions that still remains is, you know, what is sort of the cost of the, you know, added cost versus the cost savings? But one of the key things is that, you know, you're saving people from having to come in for visits that they otherwise could just be handled over the telephone. So that's the second thing we're covering on call centers. Any questions that have come in so far?
No questions at this time.
Okay. We're obviously crystal clear. So we're going to move on. We have three more to cover. So the next one's on secure messaging. So this is work that we did looking at the association between secure messaging and primary care face-to-face and phone visits. And this was in response to some work that had been published actually also by Kaiser Permanente, that when they initiated their secure messaging system to look to see, and what they showed was a reduction in face-to-face visits after initiating a secure messaging system for their patients. So we wanted to test that hypothesis in the VA, and we had a good natural experiment, again, with the adoption of secure messaging. And so as you all know, with My Healthy Vet, it was initiated in 2009, and about 2.1 million veterans are signed up. That's about 30% of PCMM that have signed up to use the secure messaging portal. So in 2013, the proportion of patients in PCMM that were using it nearly tripled, increasing from 4% to over 11% by fiscal year 17. So it's still a minority of our patients that are using secure messaging, but that number has been increasing. So we were able to look at over this time frame. So my VA Access Initiative included secure messaging in the list of possible fulfillment options for same-day care. And we actually included that in a measure of timely care that Adam Batten and others developed to look at, you know, our patients getting access to care and counting secure messaging as one of those methods. Now, one thing that was interesting that in fiscal year 17, only 10% of rural patients were actively using secure messaging in comparison to 13% of urban patients. You know, and, you know, one of the goals of, you know, initiatives like this is people that do live farther away to get them engaged in care and make it easier for them to access their provider. So it's still lower, slightly lower in rural patients. So our question is, does secure messaging influence primary care utilization? So this is, again, secure messaging through My Healthy Vet. So we looked at, in 2016, 1 year post secure messaging initiation for patients that initiated that year. So we have 25,683 new secure message users, propensity matched to 49,000 non-users from the underlying population. So this is from the primary care cohort. So at that time, it was about 5.8 million. So the matching criteria were used where they were the same primary care provider panel, their similar age, sex, service connection, and rurality, and within one-fifth of a standard deviation of the predicted propensity by the NOSO score is a sort of a comorbidity type measure we use in the VA, and their drive time to the nearest clinic. So again, patients weren't randomized, but we used propensity scores to try to match them as closely as possible. And the outcome that we were interested in was primary care utilization, whether it be face-to-face or telephone visits. So here's what we found. So the first bullet says reduction in primary care face-to-face visits by 16% or 0.23 visits per secure message with a significant absolute difference of 7%. And what that means is that both the match controls, which are on the left side there, and the secure messaging users both had a reduction in visits over this time period. And so the difference between them ends up being about 7%. And that difference was almost exactly what was shown in the work that Kaiser Permanente had published. So it's consistent with some other work. But we also saw an increase in primary care telephone visits by about 11%, or 0.27 visits per secure message, with a significant absolute difference of about 7%. So you're also getting more telephone visits as well. So we wanted to make sure we were showing that, you know, it may be squeezing the balloon a little bit, but we did show that the face-to-face visits went down. And from a patient perspective, you know, that's certainly important if they're coming in for visits that could be taken care of by secure messaging or by telephone. So based on a one-year pre- and post-event period, initiation of secure messaging in 2016 was associated with a decrease in face-to-face primary care visits and an increase in telephone visits. You know, the future work is going to look, you know, potentially do a prospective cohort study. What are some of the short-term impacts and long-term effects of this? And what are the implications for provider workload and burnout? Okay. So we're off on to our third one. Finish our third one. Any questions so far in these first three?
Yes, we do have some questions.
Okay.
One person wants to know, are there differences in clinical outcomes, simply?
Yeah, good question. For the secure messaging, we have not looked at. And, you know, for the call center one, that wasn't part of what we were trying to look at because they weren't really randomized, but it's a really good question. One of the, you know, some of the work that's been done with call centers, and a lot of the work has been done in pediatrics, and, you know, concern of whether, you know, telephone triage is safe. And, you know, within the pediatric literature, it's pretty much felt that it's a safe thing to be doing, and that there's, if you have a robust system in place to, and experienced people, and especially with experience, especially both nurses that do this and other practitioners that have done, you know, triage work by phone, you know, they get a sense for it and good experience. So, but no, we don't have good outcome measures across these.
Thank you. Another person asks, any sense how many VAs use call centers with NPs widely adopted enough to benchmark the value?
So I'm not the one that could answer that. The people in the Office of Nursing Services know the ones that do. And the GLA call center is interesting because a lot of calls from other visits actually get routed through there at different times of the day, and there's these sort of regional call centers. So, Matt, you have them.
The Bronx VA does have nurse practitioners, and I think they're expanding. It's just been recently updated. The clinical call centers are calling rather than contact. That are looking to expand these methods, along with video telehealth as another modality to increase access and treatment for patients. But the number of clinical centers that have NPs actually treating patients over the phone, I don't know the exact number.
Yeah, and it was part of a pilot that some other centers were going to do it. I don't know how many of them ended up adopting it, but the GLA one was the one that really jumped on it and initiated it.
Those are all the questions we have at this time.
Okay, so I'll turn it back over to Matt and cover next topic.
All right, thanks, Peter. The next kind of question we had is looking at the idea of panel fullness. So how many patients that an individual provider, in this case a clinic, has, and their ability to deliver the metrics that the VA has put forth as far as measuring access. So our goal was to look at the association of primary care clinic fullness with access to care and emergency department visits. So, you know, we know from the previous research done out of Seattle, actually, looking at, you know, panel size and burnout as the panel size increases. In the VA currently, there's a measure of panel fullness that they use called the modeled capacity, and that is an adjustment of the of a panel size that is expected of a provider based upon the number of support staff, rooms, clinical severity, and the number of women that are on the panel. And those adjustments give the expected size for a given clinic. For this analysis, we ignore that, and we use an unadjusted panel size, and I'll get more into that. But our question was, you know, as the panel size increases for a given clinic, does the access decrease or change over time? And so here we look at, this is just the unadjusted panel size fullness for, I believe this is clinical level. As you can see, it's pretty variable throughout the VA, as some working at 50% of their expected capacity, and some, a minority of clinics, working at above that. So, you know, ideally, you would like clinics to be right around 90 to 100% to get the optimal efficiency of treating patients. So our question is, is an unadjusted panel fullness at a clinical level associated with access to primary care and emergency department utilization? So what we did is we used a sample from the National VA. We looked at a time frame same as before due to availability of the measures we wanted to use from July of 2017 to October, 2018. The reason we used this time frame is that there was a transition of measuring panel sizes and FTE of provider. That switched from PCM Web, and we felt by July 2017 those numbers became a little bit more reliable for us to use in this analysis. So the panel fullness adjusted that we used was the observed number of patients assigned to a clinic via PCM Web on the web over the expected panel size. And the expected panel size is calculated based on VA policy is 1,200 patients per MD or DO provider, and 900 patients per NP or PA. So that's a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. So we strictly just calculated that based on the number of FTE assigned to that given clinic. The outcomes we looked at, we're looking at same day access, so that's ability to get access less than 24 hours. This new measure that we developed called timely care, which is care by phone, secure messaging, or in clinic within 48 hours. We looked at new patient wait time, we looked at established patient wait time, third next available, and we also isolated the clinics to VAMCs and looked at ED utilization. So when we did this, all these models were by looking at month, the size each month from that time frame, and we adjusted for the age, race, ethnicity, rurality. We looked at the NOSIS, which is the risk score of the given clinic for the patients in that clinic. We looked at drive time, and we also controlled for the size of the clinic. And so looking at these associations in our statistical models, we saw that as panel fullness increases, we actually see a paradoxical increase in same day and timely care. So as a panel size increases at a given clinic, their ability to actually deliver same day and timely care actually increased, although this is slightly increased. The third next available appointment, so that's a kind of a capacity measure to deliver timely care, lengthened. And then there was a slight association with increase in ED visits. So what we see here, so this is a these associations were associated, these measures here These are incident rate ratios and odds ratios, were as a 10% increase in panel size. So that's about 120 patients per FDE provider, or about 90 patients per NP or PA. So when there's an increase by 10%, we saw an improvement in timely care. We saw more urgent care and next available request fulfilled within 24 or 48 hours. That's a timely care measure. We saw a longer third next available appointment slots. Those are likely occupied by same-day requests. And we saw like a 1.1% increase in ED visits only at VAMCs. So what are the implications of this? One is to suggest that the increased ED visits may signify some time constraints or limited face-to-face appointment slots among clinics with higher panel fullness for, in order for them to provide the higher acuity and complete care that are necessary to deter the ED visits at their facility. So that's something that, that's our next steps, is to look a little bit more into that and to figure out the associations that we're seeing with this higher panel size. And I could take any questions specifically about this analysis if anybody has.
Yeah, this one just came in. This person writes, so to clarify, did you compare the panel size across providers within a specific period of time? Mm-hmm. How variable is the panel size over a period of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we did not look at individual panel sizes of teams, because that's it gets a little complicated. We looked at due to the different differences at facilities over the team interactions and sharing the patients. This is at the clinical size within itself, so over time. So this is a month-to-month variability in the size of the clinic. And there is some significant variation in some clinics and decrease in size from a month-to-month basis. And there's some clinics that are growing a little bit more rapidly than others. And that's the kind of the focus for next step, because what the question is, you know, what is driving these associations? Is it, you know, the change in the FTE, which is in the denominator? So that's like, providers leaving a facility or coming to a facility, or is it the actual number of patients that are seen within a clinic? In our updated analysis, we're taking up specifically looking at that. And second of all, we want to focus on clinics that have over this time frame, which have, you know, increased dramatically, so we could kind of see, you know, how they are handling the timely care.
Thank you. We have another question that just came in. Excuse me, I'm sorry. It's more of a comment. You may just not be seeing the increased ED visits at non-VAMCs because they are rural and more likely to go to a local non-VA ED?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's a big caveat in a lot of VA research, is that we're not looking at non-VA visits. We can look at that with, you know, the Medicare population, but again, it's limited to Medicare fee-for-service. And so we do have, you know, pretty significant limitations in identifying those non-VA ED visits, because as we know, most veterans do have coverage, and about 20 to 30% have no coverage at all. So identifying those non-VA EDs visits from claims data, it can be very difficult. So I think that's a great comment, and a comment about, you know, how we look at VA research looking at ED visits in general. And that's something that I'm looking into and address at, you know, different sources of how we can identify those ED visits outside the VA. And that's on a different platform. But yeah, that's a very good comment, and should be taken into consideration when looking at research that involves ED visits, because, you know, patients might be just simply shifting their care to non-VA sites for acute care purposes.
That was the last question we have at this time.
Okay, and I'll cover the last topic here, which is the mental health. And what we're looking at is an association between acute psychiatric bed availability and risk of suicide in a national sample of veterans from 2001 to 2016. And the reason we started this work was, when you talk about healthcare access, one of the things that has not really been described well is how you measure access to inpatient care. And, you know, if you've been watching the news lately, you know, there's a lot of talk out there about hospitals, especially mental health hospitals, not having an adequate number of beds and patients boarding in emergency rooms for hours, if not days. And so, you know, this is a question that came up based on some of our own experiences. So you know, the sort of a policy question of, you know, are hospital diversions and bed capacity, are they a measure of healthcare access and quality? And I think they are, but they're just not routinely measured, reported, or studied. Just three background areas that have been studied. So there was a systematic review that was came out in 2016 in JGM that looked at overall hospital capacity, and they used the word strain, and they found a overall increased mortality and reduced hospital quality in most studies looking at hospital capacity, but this wasn't specific to mental health. There's been quite a bit of work done in the ED literature and the risk of diversions when emergency departments have to basically go on divert. And this is actually data all the way back from 2003, but at that time, and it's much worse now, 45% of EDs reported diverting at some point during that year, and on average about 3% of the time. And you know, this type of data is not routinely collected in most hospitals, although VA does have some data on ED diversions. And the last is on ICU capacity. And there's a number of studies that have been done looking at, you know, whether ICUs are full within a hospital, and they've shown everything from a range of no impact on mortality up to a 5 times greater odds of death when you have overcrowding in an ICU. So we're going to apply this same question to mental health. So there is, you know, concern, and there's been writing about low psychiatric bed supply for serious mental illness being associated with higher suicide and premature mortality. Now, there's no papers that show that, but there's an assumption that it is. And that's why we're studying this. Extended ED wait times, which then leads to a higher threshold for admission. You know, the longer time people wait in an emergency department oftentimes result in them just being sent home or the patient just leaving the emergency department. And then short revolving door stays. So patients coming in, you know, to a mental health unit, there's constant pressure to get people out. So there's pushing people out, and then potential for higher rehospitalization. And then the issue of homelessness, violent crime, incarceration, and the concept of transit reinstitutionalization, that as we've shut down inpatient mental health beds, we're transitioning people into prisons instead and using jails for patients with mental illness. So as far as how many beds you need, there's no international consensus on a safe minimum number of beds. And just to put it in perspective, in the U.S. we have about 22,000 beds per 100,000 of our adult population. So for adult psychiatric beds, we're one of the lowest in the world, actually. The U.K. has about 50 is what they target in the National Health Service, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. And the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development countries is about 70, I think, countries, 50 to 60, I don't know, somewhere in there. They recommend that it should be around 70, and that's the average, but that's what they recommend it should be, is around 70. And interestingly, the VA currently has about 76 acute mental health beds per 100,000 veterans. So to give this perspective, like the UK and why this matters there in the National Health Service, their estimate of having 50 beds per 100,000 publicly funded beds is needed to provide as equal access to medical acute beds, a 4-hour rule for admission to an acute ward, meaning you shouldn't have to wait more than 4 hours in an emergency department for admission, and that if they can maintain an 85% occupancy rate with those beds to meet that rule and allow beds to be used for 2 to 4 weeks per patient. So that's actually a fairly long length of stay, but a generous amount of time in the hospital. So that gives you the perspective. So I'm going to show you data from our work. Oh, one more background slide, and compared to the VA. So this paper on the left just looked at association between suicide, which is the top yellow line, rates in the country, and number of psychiatric beds nationally. This doesn't have anything to do with occupancy. This is just the total number of beds. And if you look on the right, you see almost the exact same trend in the VA over a similar time period, that the blue line represents suicides and the green line represents the number of beds. But you know, that only tells part of the story, because it's really the occupancy of the beds that matters. So what we did was a cross-sectional time series with repeated measures. We have about 10 million veterans over this time period that were enrolled in primary care. So this includes at any given time, obviously veterans come and go within the VA system. And the data elements that we looked at included suicide as the outcome from the DOD VA suicide data repository. We were able to get clinical characteristics of the patients from the corporate data warehouse. Hospital level variables were from VSSC data, including the monthly hospital occupancy. And we calculated that two different ways to confirm the occupancy rates. Now, the point about occupancy rates is we only have it at the level of the month, not by day by day or hour by hour, which is a limitation of this work, but we were aggregating at a higher level anyway. And then we also included civilian or regional level characteristics to account for mental health spending and mental health beds in the community. And this came from a couple sources, the Area Health Resource File, state mental health agencies and their spending, the Census Bureau and the American Community Survey. And so the analysis was a relationship between hospital level characteristics and market level suicide rate using generalized linear mixed models. And the suicide rate was modeled as the number of suicides per quarter. And we did it by quarter because of the infrequent number of suicides we had aggregated a quarter level in using a Poisson distribution. So these are preliminary findings. That's why it says preliminary. But this is what we found so far, and we need to sort of dig a little deeper to make sure our results are robust. What we found was that there's lower rates of suicide for each additional 25 civilian psychiatric beds per 100,000 and each additional $50 spent on mental health per capita within that catchment area. And these are the second finding about mental health spending has actually been reported previously. So this is consistent with other reports that community investment in mental health services is associated with lower rates of suicide. The one about the civilian beds had not been exactly reported. And again, for the civilian beds, we do not have occupancy. But we also found higher rates of suicide based on occupancy in the VA hospital. So we have 113 acute care mental health hospitals or mental health units. So compared to hospitals in the lowest occupancy quintile, the rate ratio of suicide increased. And you can see it goes up somewhat in a dose response fashion from about 1.13 to about 1.24. And next slide, I can show it by using the forest plot. And you can see the civilian beds in the third line down, the $50 spent per capita. We included race in. Blacks have a much lower odds of rate of suicide. And then those are the four occupancy categories. And you can see the rate of occupancy. The referent category was less than 50% full. And then the top four, you know, the quintiles were 50 to 65, 65 to 75, 75 to 85, 85 to 100% occupied. So we think some implications here. So the lack of mental health bed availability, and this analysis was associated with a high risk of suicide. And we found that greater community mental health investment was protective against suicide. The future work, I mean, first of all, we need to estimate the optimal level of bed occupancy if we can and mental health spending and look at trends over time, look at geographic variation and hot spotting for high-risk areas. We do know that the Intermountain West, for example, and that's both in VA and non-VA data, has the highest risk of suicide. So these are some preliminary findings, but we'll hopefully have them finalized soon. Okay. Can take questions on that, and then we have just a couple closing slides.
We don't have any questions at this time.
Okay. I'm going to do the closing slides. We'll do the closing slides, and we'll see if there's any questions, and if none, we'll end a few minutes early. So there's a number of future access-related issues that our group and Access, newly funded Access Consortium of Research, the Access Core, is working on. The first one is, you know, related to the Mission Act. There's a number of issues that are going to have to be clarified for the Mission Act in terms of standards. So access standards for when to refer to community care. that's changed with the Mission Act, and it's going to have implications on how we refer care out. There's also criteria that were developed by a group in Boston on underserved facilities and what it means to be an underserved facility, and that was required from the Mission Act to designate this and have it designated annually. The Mission Act also is going to implement mobile deployment teams, the clinical resource hubs, which I don't have written up there, sorry, clinical resource hubs, which are provide telemedicine. There's a residency program pilot. There's a pilot for scribes. So there's a number of things that the Mission Act is going to be doing that are intended to improve access, and it's going to be important that people that study it or people that evaluate it have ways to measure it. The electronic health modernization, EHR modernization with Cerner is going to have a big impact on care. There's estimates that, implementing a new EHR reduces efficiency by 20% to 30%, which may have significant impacts on access if we become less efficient during the implementation phases. Another area is in no-shows. Currently, nationally, the no-show rate is about 11%. And in talking to people in the Office of Veterans Access to Care, ideally that should be around 5 to 6%. And you'd like that to be, steady and not be constantly fluctuating so clinics can plan accordingly. There's issues with provider and staff recruitment and retention that affect access, and I think this gets at Matt's work on panel size and ensuring that we have the right number of providers in the right locations, and then when we don't, how do you make up for those gaps in coverage? The clinical resource hubs that are being implemented are going to be one of those ways to make up for those gaps, and we need to be able to measure the provider availability and provider FTEs. Last couple things, there's continued expansion of virtual care to improve access, whether it be e-consults, specialty care, telemedicine, telehospitals, stroke care, expansion of the tele-ICUs, all those are intended to improve access. The last two, access-related marketing and satisfaction, keeping track of veteran perception of access through the SHEP surveys, but also with the new V-Signals methodology that contacts veterans immediately after visits, I think is going to be really important to understand, where we have problems with perceived access. And when we have really good access, how do we market that better? I think to overcome some of the misinformation that sometimes gets out. And the last thing we talked a little bit about at the end there was access to inpatient beds. The veteran population is dropping in most areas, but some areas have increases, and are they going to be able to have the adequate number of beds in those areas where veteran numbers increase? So those are the future issues, and we'll take any other questions. And we'd like to thank our collaborators there at the bottom in Seattle and Iowa City for all the hard work on this and allowing us to present it.
We do have a couple questions that came in.
Go ahead.
This one's a little bit long. What directionality do you attribute to the results related to occupancy? Could lower suicide in lower occupancy be related to an underlying lower prevalence of severe mental illness in the population?
Yeah, so good question. And we were just literally this morning, Bjarni and Matt and I were talking about that exact question and looking at some stratified analysis about whether patients have a mental health diagnosis or not, because only roughly about half of veterans who commit suicide actually have a mental health diagnosis. So I think that's a really good question, because if you don't have a mental health diagnosis and you don't seek care for mental health, you really can't be admitted to the hospital for acute mental illness, and that with the hope that that prevents a suicide. And so we stratified the analysis by the presence or absence of a mental health diagnosis, and we don't see an association with the stratified group with no mental illness, and those with a mental illness, actually the relationship's a little bit stronger. So, that's part of what we're trying to tease out, and that's exactly the kind of questions we were working on even as of this morning. So thank you.
Thank you. How will data be shared from the VA CCN/PCN network?
I'm not sure which, I mean, there's, I'm not sure which network that refers to specifically. I mean, all the data that we use for these analysis either came from the CDW, you know, VSSC, or other, you know, publicly available data. So this, all the data we use is data that's available to researchers and administrators within VA.
Okay, thank you. We have one final question. Are you available for consultation on other rural health projects?
Oh, yeah, you bet. That's, you know, that's one of the key things that we're doing, you know, that we do through our Rural Health Resource Center here in Iowa City, but also through the new Access Core. And that Access Core was just announced yesterday as funded. So it's with myself here in Iowa City. It's led by Mike Ho in Denver, and then other co-PIs are Stephanie Shimada in Boston and Samir Saini in Ann Arbor. And as part of the Access Core, you know, we're going to make ourselves available for access-related research questions, and certainly rural health has a lot of access-related things. So, yeah, just send me a note and happy to help.
Well, that was the final question we had at this time. If either of you have closing comments you'd like to make, I'd like to give you an opportunity to do that.
No, I just want to thank everybody that has worked on these various projects, and you know, we're welcome to any feedback that anybody has that listened in, positively or negatively. That's fine, and you know, we're always looking for new ways to measure access, because ultimately, you know, if we're going to improve access, we have to have ways to measure it and ways to report it so that we know where we have deficiencies. And this will be work that's going on for the next few years, probably forever. So happy to take any suggestions. That's all I have. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.